Thank you very much. So reverse sequence testing, what's going on? And that's a good way to start after that. This is the audience participation part. Since we don't have microphones around the room, you're just going to have to scream out the answer, and it'll probably be better than mine.
Assaulted.
Two peanuts walk into a bar. One was?
Assaulted.
Assaulted, okay. One star. A sandwich walks into a bar. The barman says, sorry, we don't serve food in here. Yeah, okay. All right, my favorite. Two hydrogen atoms walk into a bar. One says, I've lost my electron. The other says, are you sure? The first replies, yes.
Positive.
I'm positive. Okay. We got a great group in here. And, you know, it can be funny when words have multiple meanings, but when those words are syphilis test sensitivity and specificity, it can cause some problems. And so what I'm going to do in this talk, I'm going to start by talking about what do we mean when we say a syphilis test anyway. And I'm going to compare screening with an RPR first. I'm going to use RPR for non-treponemal just because it's a little easier to distinguish from treponemal first. And how does that work in different settings? What are the implications of the new treponemal rapid test that we have for outreach screening? And what's the significance of people who have a positive treponemal test with a negative non-treponemal test anyway? Okay, so why do we do a syphilis test? Well, I think we do a syphilis test to see if someone's infectious or infected. And by that, we want to know if that person can benefit from treatment. Now you might say, well, we also do that to see if treatment's worked. But really, that's the same question as, does this person still have an infection? Are they infected? Sometimes we get positive results in other situations, which we come to think are normal, but they're really not very helpful. If we find someone serofast, someone's had a past infection, they've already been treated adequately, you know, life would be easier if that test was just negative, but it's not. And we have come to not really question that too much, but that's a problem. What do syphilis tests actually tell us? Well, non-treponemal tests tell us about antibody to cardiolipin, and that gives us some good information about the activity of infection. And it can remain positive after treatment, usually for a few months, sometimes years, sometimes if a person gets treated late in infection, it can remain positive forever. Sometimes it's false positive in IDUs, people with other infections, immunoglobulin disorders, and so on. And so there are some instances where it's positive even for no reason that is even close to helpful. Treponemal tests are more specific for treponemes. They actually tell you whether someone's got antibody to treponemes, and that can tell you about current or past infection. Problem is, a treponemal test usually remains positive forever. There can also be positive with other treponemes, such as those that cause Pinta or yaws, and sometimes they're positive in other conditions, maybe because of other spirochetes, and sometimes for reasons we don't know. So when we do a syphilis test and talk about the sensitivity, you know, it doesn't often go that we actually ask the question, is it identifying everyone with infection who needs treatment? We usually look at the test to see whether it's identifying someone who truly has antibody. That's not what anyone wants to know when they're doing a syphilis test. Same with specificity. Specificity, what we really want it to do is tell us who does not have an infection, who does not need treatment, but really it tells us more about antibody, and that is not all that helpful. So let's look at a couple of studies that have compared testing first with the RPR and then with the treponemal EIA as the first part of the screening algorithm to see how results differ using those tests to try to figure out if someone has syphilis. And I'm going to use data from a paper by Mishra and others that looked at the Toronto area where they screened between 1998 and 2008 and tested over 3 million specimens during that time period. And I'm going to simplify it by assuming that by just standardizing it to 1,000 infections. And when they started with the RPR first between August of 98 and July 2005, this is what they found. They had 1,000, for every 1,000 they tested by the RPR, 994 were negative. So they just, that was the end of that. Six were positive, and then those positives needed to get confirmed with a treponemal test. And they found on average five of those six were positive and then were said to have positive syphilis test. Now, if they started in August of 2005, they started using the reverse sequence, which starts with the treponemal first. And of every 1,000 they did with a treponemal test, 978 tested negative, 22 tested positive, and then they would do the RPR on those. And when the RPR was done, on average, 6 of those were positive. So the first thing to see is that roughly there's the same number of positives on the RPR and the treponemal test, no matter which way you're testing. And that's good. We'd sort of expect that. Now, these aren't the same people. It's the same population. But you can see that, on average, they did about the same. But what about these 16 over here? And that's the problem. When you're starting with a treponemal test, you're identifying these individuals who are positive on a treponemal test and negative on the RPR. Now, when they were negative after screening with an RPR, we got a negative treponemal test, we could ignore those because we just said those are false positive. But we're not so sure we can ignore these 16 who have a negative RPR. The reason for that is the RPR, as shown in this graph from Sandy Larson, shows that sometimes, even without treatment, the RPR can become negative. And if you look at that dark line, dark curve on the bottom, you can see about 5% of people with a negative RPR will have a negative RPR even without treatment after 10 years, and about 15% after 30 years. And so when these people have a positive treponemal and negative RPR, we still wonder if maybe they might be infected. And so what we do with them is we do a second treponemal test, and what Mishra did was a TPPA, and they found that 14 of the 16 were positive on average for a second treponemal test. And what they report in their paper is 14 or 20 people therefore had confirmed positives. And they're called confirmed positives, although notice that 14 of these confirmed positives had a negative RPR. So what does this mean to have a test result where they have a positive treponemal but negative non-treponemal, negative RPR? It could mean past infection where they got treated and the RPR became negative. It could mean a past infection where maybe they don't know they were treated, but maybe they were because they took some antibiotics for some other reason. Maybe they were never treated and it just became negative. Or maybe they continue to be infected. We don't know. So what Mishra did was they did an interesting thing. They had all these millions of specimens, and they looked at people who happened to get another test after this test. And what they said was there were 9,137 who were treponemal positive, RPR negative, that got retested again within 2 months, and 0.59% of them tested positive the second time with the RPR, and the implication being maybe those people really were infected, and they were developing antibody, and they went from negative to positive. But my question is, well, how many of the treponemal negative would have tested positive if you'd have retested those in 2 months? We don't know. And also, what does it mean to have a positive test the second time? Did it start out as negative and then it comes back borderline positive because they really had a low non-treponemal test? I don't know. And they don't know either, because this is a study that's based on lab results. But what we recommend is that if you have a positive, that's a test that's positive and confirmed by another treponemal test, that those should be treated if they have not previously been treated. Okay, so that's where the recommendations are right now. We don't know for sure that that should be done, but that's the recommendation. Let's look at another study that looked at both laboratory and clinical data. And this is a study that Binneker did here in Minnesota. And fortunately, he did exactly 1,000 patients, so I didn't have to do anything with the math on that. And he actually tested the same people using both algorithms. And you can see that the starting with the RPR, he had 996 that were negative, and 4 were positive. All 4 had a positive treponemal test. When he started with a treponemal test, 995 were negative, 15 had a positive treponemal test, of whom 4 confirmed. And those are the exact same 4 patients, fortunately. 11 had a negative RPR, and of those, 5 had a positive TPPA. Now, the advantage of Binnaker is he had the clinical information. And what he found was, of the 4 who had positive treponemal and non-treponemal, there's really only 1 who had a new infection. 3 of them were follow-up titers that he could find in the chart that they were doing as a follow-up test. If he looked at the 5 who had positive TPPA after a negative RPR, 3 of them had been treated in the past. Fortunately, you could get that out of the chart, although you might not be able to always. And 2 of them, as far as he could tell, had never been treated. So then the question is, what's the sensitivity of the RPR for detecting syphilis in this case? We'll assume that all 3 of the cases have been identified, if there's even 3. Maybe there's only 1. If you'd use the RPR first, you would think there was only 1 new infection. If you use the treponemal, you might argue, as Mishra did, that there were 3 infections and that the RPR just missed 2 of them. Secondly, what's the specificity if you do the treponemal test first? Well, there were 985 that were called negative right away, and there were 6 that were called negative after the second treponemal test. So that makes, 991. The denominator's either 997 or 999, depending on how many cases you think there were. But either way, the specificity is really good. It's over 99%. Now, a couple things about what we do with these infections. First of all, the health department is most concerned about stopping infection in the community. So the health department's going to concentrate on people who've got new infections, and that's going to be the people who have the positive RPR by far and away. So the health department's really going to concentrate on these same few people in any situation. But the clinicians need to deal with everyone who's got a positive result. So the clinician has this extra mess down at the bottom with the people who may or may not have been treated in the past. The clinician's going to have to make that decision. And I would submit that the health department would be in would probably want to help those clinicians when you first start out using this test, to let that clinician know that these are patients that are probably not infectious, but you may want to treat them because they if they've never been treated in the past. So a letter to those clinicians with negative RPRs might be helpful in that situation. So now we've looked at 2 different studies, and I'm showing both of their results on this slide, and they actually are pretty much the same. And in fact, I found a 3rd study that came out of the Brigham in Boston that had results that were also quite good. And you can see that with the starting with the treponemal test, about 98% are negative on that treponemal test, and you can forget about them. And so it actually works pretty well in these settings, I would say, that you do that test, and most of the time you don't have much to worry about. And you're probably saving money, because doing 1,000 treponemal tests is faster and cheaper than doing 1,000 RPRs. But then I looked at another study, and this study looked at high-risk individuals, and this was in the MMWR. And what they found in this study was really, really different. And here's where the problem comes in. You can see that they had 145 out of 1,000, or 14.5%, were positive on the treponemal test. Of those, about half were positive on the RPR, and most of those who were negative on the RPR were positive on the second treponemal test. So this is way more than were positive using the other approach. Now, it's important to point out that of these 73 who have positive treponemal and non-treponemal tests, it's probably most of them don't even have syphilis. Maybe, let's guess, 7 have syphilis because this is the first time they found out about it and they haven't been treated yet. So if 7 really have syphilis, then my question is, what's the specificity of this test using the treponemal first approach for identifying it. Well, 855 were negative to begin with, 10 were negative after the second treponemal test. That's only 865 out of 993, or 87.1%. So that's a pretty poor specificity for a test, I would say, especially when you're going to have to do some work to find out what happened with all those who have a positive test. And at some point, the extra work from chasing all of those people with a positive treponemal and negative non-treponemal test is going to exceed the cost savings that you get from using an automated EIA. And the person who's chasing all of those is going to complain to the laboratory that you're giving us too many positives, we can't handle it. So what does this say about screening with rapid treponemal tests? Well, first of all, even when you test with the RPR first, many people who have positive tests do not have syphilis. And so I've collected some data here from four different studies that were screening in high prevalence areas, which is where you'd want to go if you had a rapid test. And what they reported was how many had a positive RPR, because they were doing RPR first, and how many of those ended up having new syphilis. And you can see that only about one-sixth of those who had a positive RPR actually turned out to be a new case. So even when you're testing with the RPR first, you're finding a lot of infection, a lot of positives that aren't helpful because they're not cases. And I would guess that if you're finding about one out of six with an RPR as a new case, only about one out of 12 with a treponemal test is going to be a new case. So you're going to be finding a lot of people who are positive on your rapid test who don't have syphilis. Now, one way of reducing this nuisance would be by asking people before you test them, have you ever had syphilis? If they've had syphilis before, then you don't do the rapid test, okay? So I think that might be the approach you need to do with a rapid treponemal test. However, if you don't retest the past positives, you're going to miss some of your syphilis, especially now when syphilis is concentrated in gay men. And I've got a couple of examples here. One comes from San Francisco, where they found 6.7% of syphilis cases in 2002, so it's a while ago, were reinfected within a year. So a lot of repeat infections. In Miami, Toy Brewer looked at how many people had been diagnosed in the past, and 11.7% of the cases diagnosed in Miami in 2008 had had syphilis diagnosed somewhere in Florida within the preceding 7 years. So if you don't test those, you're going to miss some. And so that brings me to the question, do we really need to do anything for these people who have a negative RPR? Are they infectious? And do they actually benefit from treatment? First of all, are they infectious? And I would, for that, recommend that you see poster number P36 by Dan Newman. You can see it today, but if you see it tomorrow, Dan will be standing there. And he looked at whether pregnant women with positive treponemal and persistently negative non-treponemal tests transmit syphilis to their babies. And it's an analysis of transmission congenitally, and I'll say, doesn't look like a lot of transmission, if any, is going on there, but you really need to talk to Dan about that one. Now, what's the consequences of a long-term infection or positive treponemal, negative non-treponemal test? And I think our data from that mostly comes from old cohort studies, like the Oslo cohort, where there were persons with untreated syphilis diagnosed between 1890 and 1910. In this cohort, they followed 80% of the original cohort. There was 1,404, and they followed them to 1950. Now, here's the audience participation part. What was the leading cause of death in the Oslo cohort? It's not a multiple choice. You got to call it out, because I don't have the technology. Cardiovascular. Thank you. Someone answered, but you're wrong. Someone else. TB. Okay, someone has heard that slide before. And it's right, TB. Okay, in men, TB was a leading cause of death. Syphilis came in second. In women, TB was a leading cause of death. Syphilis came in, looks like, about fourth or fifth. Okay, so that's in the Oslo cohort. But nonetheless, 10-15% of those who had syphilis in the Oslo cohort ended up dying of it. And that's probably an underestimate because they didn't do autopsies, so some of them may have had cardiovascular syphilis. But nowadays, I think syphilis is a little different. For example, gammas are really rare. In the Oslo cohort, a gamma was seen in about 15% of everyone in the Oslo cohort. And the onset could have been years later, but usually about 15 years. When Sparling wrote about gammas in the Holmes textbook, he said late benign syphilis was approaching the vanishing point even before penicillin. And now someone wrote about cerebral syphilitic gammas that were once common, but since 1900s, there's only 156 reported cases, only 43 since 1980. So gammas have become really rare. Cardiovascular syphilis is now also very rare. In the Oslo cohort, 14% of men and 8% of women, probably an underestimate, had cardiovascular syphilis. In the Philadelphia General Hospital autopsy series, 6.9% of all people that died in the Philadelphia General Hospital had cardiovascular syphilis. That's a tremendous amount. By 1950 in Brooklyn, it was down to 0.8%. And so now, if you have seen a case of cardiovascular syphilis, hold up your clicker. Remarkable, not too many. How many have seen one in the last 2 years? No one. How many deaths are there to syphilis? In the 40s, it was 14,000 a year. By 2004, last year that I could even find the information for, it was 43. So syphilis deaths are changing. And so my question is, if treponemal positive RPR negative folks are really at risk for tertiary syphilis, why aren't we seeing more tertiary syphilis in those individuals? And if we're not seeing tertiary syphilis, are we really helping those people by treating them? So in conclusion, screening with a treponemal test identifies people who have a positive treponemal, negative non-treponemal test who we think should be treated. If you're in an area with where syphilis is rare, it's going to be a small percentage of those people in that area, so it's probably going to work well and it'll be a good test. If you're in an area where syphilis is common, it's going to be a high percentage of all the people you're testing for syphilis, and it's going to be a pain working with that test. Rapid treponemal tests might help outreach screening if high risk, if you're screening high risk persons who have no history of syphilis. And so we need to learn more about the significance of treponemal and not people who are positive on a treponemal test and negative on a non-treponemal test. We really need to find out what the prognosis is for them and whether or not we're really helping them by doing that testing. So I want to ask one more question before I finally close out, and that is, how many people have used the outreach rapid treponemal test? No one. Okay, we got some plans, so that'll be good. So it'll be good to see that. And finally, two syphilis tests have had a few beers. The EIA says, yeah, I like you, you're sensitive. And the RPR, she responds, can you be more specific? I love this crowd. What a great crowd. And so I want to be more specific and say, hey, can someone please, we got smart people in here, can someone please invent a syphilis test that determines whether or not a patient has syphilis? Thank you. Okay, we have time for questions or anecdotes or anything you would like to say. And yeah, please come to the microphone because we like your voice and we want to record it.
Thank you, Tom. Harlan Roplat in LA County Department of Public Health. So we are actually trying to develop a home collection dried blood spot syphilis test using an existing treponemal test, that's a serologic test. And so this is all very interesting, and we are going to tell people this is not going to work if you've had syphilis in the past. Go to a clinic to get retested so you don't lose people with new infection. But we are going to have this eventuality. It looks like we're going to have people who then, after they get their positive result, are going to go to clinic and get RPR negative, and then it's not, we thought we were done, but apparently we're not. So I guess it's an anecdote more than a question,
but a pre-anecdote. The problem is if you get a positive treponemal negative RPR, you're going to have to do a second treponemal test. And the current recommendations are, if they're positive on that second test, you got to treat them. Three doses of benzathine.
As a late infection,
because that's what they've got, if they've never been treated for syphilis.
So we're going to have to kind of keep following this story as we get closer to rolling out that program. So
it's And wouldn't it be great if there was a way of telling if they really had syphilis or not? Then
yes, it would.
You'd know if that was worth doing all of that, but we don't.
Thank you.
Thanks for that. I found it very interesting. My name is Kirk Bench. I work for Utah Unified Public Health Laboratories. And I just had a question about the logic of assuming that only 7 of the 75 positive RPR positive treponemal tests would be true cases. You kind of lost me on the logic.
Right.
Are we assuming that there's only 7 that are like active recent cases, or are we assuming that the EIA is not very specific in that population?
No, what that's assuming is you're testing a high-risk population where a lot of them have had syphilis in the past and been treated and still have positive RPR.
So we're just assuming that of the 75, 7 would be recent cases, and the other 70 or so would be...
Yeah, they have probably...
Old treated
almost
cases
all of them have had syphilis in the past, right.
Okay.
So like, for example, here when you've got positive RPRs, a small number of those actually ended up having...
That makes
recent
sense.
Recent infection.
And I also wondered if you could comment on, and I know it's probably not directly related to what your presentation was, but is one test better than the other at identifying syphilis in an immunocompromised person? Are you aware of studies that show that, say, you know, in somebody that maybe has advanced HIV, that an RPR might detect when an EIA might miss it, or vice versa? Thanks.
You know, I think there are some subtle differences in the sensitivity of these tests. I have not gone into that because I think the bigger issue is the way the test is being done and the populations that are being tested is going to cause most of the discrepancies between who's infected and who's not. So there probably are some differences in sensitivity of these individual tests, but it's not going to be great. It's not going to be much.
Right.
Practically speaking, won't help you too much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks.